This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaki on Culture and Race, Part 1. I thought I was done with Yaki. I spent longer talking about his views on liberalism than I had intended to originally. But there is something about Yaki that's worth talking about, if only as a launching point off into other things. And when it came to philosophy, that's not really my cup of tea. I'm not knowledgeable about it. I'm not all that interested in it. But the fact that it had to do with European history and European politics was enough for me to take an interest in it for as long as I did. And I hope that my regular listeners enjoyed that. And I think that, like me, if you did enjoy that, you'll enjoy this even more. Because this is really more my cup of tea, more interesting to me, even though I think Yaki is more wrong on this. He's more of an authority and more authoritative on philosophy than he is on culture and race, although I'll grant him culture even. Why don't we just get right into it and discuss it. There was an article recently at Countercurrents written by Anthony Gannon, who is a former associate of Yaki's, and I couldn't determine when it was written. It seems to be something timeless. It could have been written decades ago. It could have been written yesterday. It could have been written specifically for Countercurrents. I couldn't find any other match for certain key phrases in it, so I don't know about it. But what's interesting about it is it gives some information about Yaki. One thing that caught my attention was that his pen name, Ulrich Varange, is symbolic. According to Anthony Gannon, says it's symbolic of the extremities of Europe as seen by Yaki. Ulrich was an Irish name indicating the western boundary, whilst the Varange were nomadic tribesmen operating on the eastern fringes of Europe. I went and looked up Ulrich to try and figure out how it's pronounced, and I couldn't find a pronunciation of it, but it is a Gaelic Irish name, means Little William, and the Varange are these nomadic tribesmen out on to the east. Something else that Anthony Gannon said that was interesting. He talked a little bit about the history between Yaki and Oswald, Oswald Mosley, fairly well-known British fascist before World War II, and served in prison, served time and was put in prison or in prison during World War II. He says here that I will say no more on the disjunction between Yaki and Sir Oswald, as there is nothing constructive to be gained from raking over old ashes. That's a shame. I'd like to know more about what their difference was that caused the split between them, because it seems like they were very much in tune otherwise on in the big picture. He continues, indeed, it is true that Yaki was disappointed that neither he nor Imperium found favor with the remnants of the pre-war British fascism in general. He attracted the bitter and stupid hostility of Arnold Lees, the leader of the former Imperial Fascist League, along with his latter-day disciples such as AFX Baron and Company, the Britons, and sundry other of like mind. Of course, all these groupings were equally opposed to Sir Oswald Mosley and his ideas, so there was no organized common front per se against Yaki. He was just someone else to hate. His sin, in their eyes, and this is where it's interesting and ties into the topic of this installment. His sin, in their eyes, was to reject vertical race rooted in 19th century materialistic thinking and to put in its place the 20th century system of horizontal race, spiritual race. However, it is true beyond doubt that the main reason why so many of those who could have been expected to support Yaki's ideas did not do so for another reason, jealousy. Jealousy of his intellect and ability. In every intellectual exchange between Yaki and others which I ever witnessed, Yaki always emerged the winner, and almost all the losers never forgave him for this. A little further on, he gives a hint as to what's really going on there. He writes, in almost every case, such people were visibly impressed by his intellect. He's talking about people who have met Yaki. They were visibly impressed by his intellect and power of expression, and certainly they had never met anyone like him before. He was a talented pianist who could play in the works of Chopin and Liszt in concert hall style, and with a fire and expression that was remarkable. Ladies liked Yaki, and he liked the ladies. They felt his magnetism and intensity and responded readily to both. Some of the people we met were German-born, and with them Yaki would converse in German without difficulty, most of them congratulating him on his grasp of the language and on his accent. In spite of first impressions, and this is where we get a hint as to what the problem was between Yaki and other people, including probably Mosley, if Yaki met some people frequently and for long periods, there was always the chance of a quarrel. He did not suffer fools gladly, and could become quite insulting and contemptuous to those he believed were being unduly obstinate or slow in conceding a point in dispute. So there Gannon hints that Yaki really was the problem, that just being around Yaki for any long period of time, the chance that you would have a falling out with Yaki approached a probability of one. So, and that's not true of everyone, but it was true of Yaki, according to Gannon. So that was probably the problem there between him and Mosley, or at least part of it anyway. I did a special program about a year ago at the White Network that was dedicated to Oswald Mosley. I wanted to know more about him, and I went and looked, and I didn't find all that much online. There is a website that's dedicated to him, and makes available several recordings of speeches that he gave. In my special program, I gathered three separate ones, and the first was rather short, from probably the earliest period of time. It might have even been pre-war, I don't recall now, but the latter two were more common, had more in common with the subject tonight and with Yaki's passion, and where they had something in common. And Mosley's theme in both of those speeches was Europe a nation, both in 1951, which was right around the same time that he was having dealings with Yaki. He had already fallen out with Yaki in 48, but 47, Yaki was writing his book. He published it in 48, finally. And they were both creating organizations in 48, 49. So in 51, Mosley was speaking about Europe a nation, which to me is an oxymoron, to see Europe as a nation. It's an abuse of the word nation. But you have to listen to Mosley and listen to his argument to understand the point he's getting at there. And in the second one, Make Europe a Nation in 1964. So, more than 10 years later, he was still promoting that idea. And the organization that he created in 1948 was the Union Movement. In the wake of the war, according to Metapedia, the Union Movement attempted to redefine the concept of nationalism, I guess, by stressing the importance of European unity rather than narrower country-based nationalisms. And it's described as its political position is described as national Europeanism and European socialism, I guess, as opposed to or in contrast to national socialism. Now, Yaki was originally a member of this Union Movement in 48, but quickly broke with Mosley and created his own organization along with Anthony Gannon, and they called it the European Liberation Front, ELF. Metapedia has an article on them as well that describes their political position as social nationalism, like Golden Dawn in Greece, and European nationalism, as opposed to national Europeanism of the Union movement, and third positionism, which is really kind of a euphemism for fascism. It's third positionism is really just the third way, not capitalism and not communism, and implicitly not Jewish, because both capitalism and communism are Jewish. Now, the thing about both Mosley's and his movement, the Union movement, and Yaki and the ELF is this drive for a united Europe. And you could say we have that today, the European Union. And the thing about it, though, is that it's really hated. It's unanimously detested by European nationalists today. And even though they don't have the power to leave the European Union, much of their platforms is to get their countries out, get their remove their nations from under the yoke of the European Union, because they see the European Union as a poisonous influence. And the difference, that's worth a whole nother podcast or series of podcasts just focusing on maybe what the difference in vision was between what Mosley and Yaki's organizations were getting at and what the European Union that finally came to be are about. And probably the simplest in a single word to describe it would be economics, that the current European Union is based on economic premises of economic union where the people don't matter, whereas I think both Mosley and Yaki cared about the European people and would have been disgusted by the European Union as it stands today. But the interesting thing about that is how the idea, whatever popularity it had, was hijacked by and redirected into supporting the European Union. Arnold Liess, the name that was mentioned by Gannon there as another person who didn't like Yaki, another fascist in Britain, is interesting. Paul Hickman at the Voice of Albion at Renegade Broadcasting back in April did a podcast about Arnold Liess and read a bit from his autobiography, Out of Step, Events in the Lives of an Anti-Jewish Camel Doctor. And the main difference, I think, between Liess and Oswald is pretty obvious, that Liess didn't hold any punches, didn't pull any punches about the Jews. He spoke directly about the Jews and recognized them for what they are and spoke very much against them. Whereas Mosley, whether he understood or not, I think it would be difficult to imagine that he didn't understand what the Jews were about. But maybe like Jared Taylor of today tried to take tried to finesse the point and work around the Jews without antagonizing them. And that's very clear on that special program that I did that I'll link in the program post about especially in the years after World War II and in the 1960s, 1970s, when he did an interview with William F. Buckley, talking. Buckley questioned him on the Jews right away about the relationship between fascism and the Jews. And Mosley was spineless as far as dealing with the Jews. At that point, he really was at the end of his life. He, if he did feel strongly about the Jews being actually responsible in some way, playing a role in the things that he saw that were bad, that were happening, that he opposed, he didn't say it. He instead played it down. And Arnold Liess didn't. So I give Arnold Liess credit for that, and thank you to Paul Hickman for bringing him to my attention. I had never heard of Arnold Liess before. So back, we're going to go back to Imperium, but this we're going to pick up here after skipping a bit. After Yaki writes about liberalism, he writes about democracy and communism, a few other things. But then he gets to a section that he titles Cultural Vitalism. And the very first section of that is titled Cultural Health. And he begins, this is on page 245 of his Imperium. He begins with three quotes, two from Napoleon and one from Spengler. Napoleon looms large in, Yaki's mind. The first quote from Napoleon is, "I recognize only two nations, the Occident and the Orient." The Occident is, Occident and Orient are terms that go back to the Roman Empire. The Occident is the Western half of the empire, and the Orient is the Eastern half of the empire. And, you know, today most people would think the Orient means, you know, Orientals means East Asians. But in the days of the Romans, it meant anything from, I don't know where the dividing line would be, anything to the east of Rome, I suppose, but certainly to the east of Constantinople. And it's interesting, Napoleon split Europe into those two nations, what he said, what he called nations. So he had this fairly high-level view of Europe, that it was really only two parts to it, east and west. Then comes a quote from Spengler. "It is want of race and nothing else that makes intellectuals, philosophers, doctrinaires, utopists, incapable of understanding the depth of this metaphysical hatred, which is the beat difference of two currents of being manifested as an unbearable dissonance, a hatred that may become tragic for both." I don't know what metaphysical hatred specifically Spengler was referring to there, but it seems to me he's talking about racial animus. And he's talking about people like intellectuals, philosophers, doctrinaires, who are unaware of race, fail to take it into account in understanding the racial animus, the incompatibility between two groups of people. This is something that in today's world, most people don't see between Jews and whites, between Jews and Europeans. They look the other way at it. They refuse to see the Jew animus toward Europeans. And part of that has to do with the fact that the Jews are constantly complaining about Europeans being the ones who have the animus for the Jews. And so that puts Europeans in their own minds on the defensive. They don't want to appear to be bad people or mean people, and so they try not to be, and they make the mistake of being too nice with the Jews. The third quote is a much longer quote from Napoleon. "I wanted to prepare the fusion of the great interests of Europe, as I had accomplished that of the parties. I concerned myself little with the passing rancor of the peoples, for I was sure that the results would lead them irresistibly back to me. Europe would in this way have become, in truth, a united nation, and everyone would have been, no matter where he traveled, in the same fatherland. This fusion will accomplish itself sooner or later through the pressure of the facts, the impulse has been given, which, since my downfall and the disappearance of my system, will make the restoration of balance possible in Europe only by merger and fusion of the great nations." So Yaki undoubtedly quoted Napoleon there because this describes his thinking about Europe, about the unity of Europe, about the inevitability of the unity of Europe. Specifically, it makes me uncomfortable to see this expression of this utopian vision of a Europe in which everyone can travel wherever they want and be in the same fatherland. That is very much like what the European Union has become, that people can go wherever they want, move around. And that is very destructive to the national identities, the regional differences, and the sub-racial ethnic differences between the peoples of Europe, the linguistic differences, the religious differences, all the little nuances of their cultures, their different dress and different heroes and legends. Those are all things that anyone who really cares about Europe would like to see continue and preserved, and not see this single fatherland. Now, there's a sense in which you can have both. They are not incompatible ideas. You can have a Europe in which the various nations have their national identities, but are also aware of their European identity, of their beyond their own borders, that their neighbors are also more distant relatives, and it tapers off the farther away you get, but that they still have something in common with each other. And that's certainly what attracted me to Yaki initially, was this idea that Europe does have something in common that all Europeans share. And of course, it's problematic, you know, where are the borders of Europe exactly? Well, it's the same thing really with any one nation within Europe. It's the same thing with any one ethnic group within Europe. Both the nations and the ethnies within Europe are rooted more firmly. They have language and religion and those other cultural nuances in common with each other that Europeans together don't share. But Europeans have things in common with each other that the rest of the world doesn't share with them, that Africans and Asians don't share. So it's really just a matter of scale and a matter of scope and a matter of feeling, you know, that the feeling of camaraderie and brotherhood amongst a family is stronger than it is within a larger tribe, and the feeling for the tribe is stronger than it is for the larger ethnic, and so on and so forth. The people who try to pretend that it stops cold at one point, it probably does for them. They don't feel anything beyond that point. But the mistake is in projecting that to everyone. Not everyone feels that it stops at the family, or it stops at the tribe, or it stops at the ethnic, or it stops at the nation. And there are people who blindly think the whole human race is their brotherhood, their family, or think all of life have some connection with all of life. It's a continuum. As I said, Napoleon divided it into East and West, which is interesting because that's not really where the racial clines are. There are other people have noticed the racial distinctions, sub-racial distinctions within Europe. When I've talked about nation and ethnic and race before, I've pointed out that you can see them as sort of Russian dolls that were layers of an onion that fit within each other. There's this continuum that I've just described, that within the race there are many nations. Within the nations there are even smaller groups, ethnic groups. But there are also groupings between nation and race. There's the Germanics, for instance, which different people draw the boundaries at different places, but constitutes, you know, most of Northern and Western Europe. You could consider Germanic. And then there are the Mediterranean peoples, again, several different countries to the south of Europe. And then there are the Slavic peoples, who all seem to have something in common with each other, not just language, but they have a biological commonality as well. Race scientists in the 19th century and early 20th century divided Europe into three sub-races, the Nordic, the Alpine, and the Mediterranean, which corresponded roughly to this Germanic, Slavic, Mediterranean groupings. But not quite exactly. I mean, the point is that these are fuzzy groups, and anything between nation and race is overlapping. And even within the nations, the different ethnies sometimes cross borders. They have more in common with people on the other side of a national border from them. So these things, it's not a perfect onion. It's really several factors. But the point about them being at different scales, I think, holds. That's valid. Yaki himself, as we get a little further into what he had to say on this, in this section and on this subject, he distinguishes mainly between, two races. That's probably the wrong word for it, but two parts to Europe, to the European peoples, the masses and the culture bearing stratum. And, anticipating a bit, I would guess that in his mind, it's the culture bearing stratum that is the race and, or the race bearing stratum, if I could abuse his terminology there. And that the masses are just led, that they're not, all that important. You get a very, a sense of an elitist attitude from Yaki. But it's also realistic, I suppose. You know, what he says you can't really argue with when it comes to the masses, being fairly inert and uninvolved in, what's going on. One thing I will take issue with as we go through here is the preeminence that Yaki assigns to spirit over biology and materialism. And as we saw in his critique of liberalism, he was very much down on materialism. He saw liberalism as springing from and very much related to an overemphasis and an obsession with materialism. And I think his thinking about race was in part carrying on with that idea that materialism is overdone. And so, and we saw even there in Anthony Gannon's description of it that he saw 19th century vertical race as materialist, and that's why he didn't like that idea. So that's part of what we're going to dig into here and explore. Now, part of the preeminence of spirit that Yaki assigns to spirit, you can see in his own terminology where he talks about the Western culture and the Western civilization. He doesn't talk about the white man or the European man so much. He talks about the West. And specifically about culture and civilization. And to me, to my mind, culture and civilization are things that spring from the European man. These are things we don't really have to worry about. These are things that we just do. We just are. We can't help ourselves but create the culture that we create and create the civilization that we create, at least when we're left to our own devices, when we're parasitized as we are and have been for a very long time, then we can't create those things. But Yaki, and again, the same criticism I had of his description of liberalism was he speaks very much from a Eurocentric point of view as if nobody else is really saying anything about what liberalism is there's no Jewish influence in liberalism, at least in his version of liberalism. And it's very similar when it comes to Western culture and Western civilization. Although in future installments, we'll get into the Western culture and how Jews relate to that. We'll talk specifically about, he called them the culture distorters and culture parasites. So, some interesting things, coming up in, future installments.